Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. This show has representatives from Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs, Anchorage Nordic Sea Patrol, and the Alaska Incident Management Team. I'm your host, Paul Torduck, and we'll discuss their organizations and how search and rescue works in Alaska. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. I have four folks with us here, three in the studio, one on the phone to talk to us and fill us in today about how about the search and rescue resources in Alaska or in South Central Alaska and sort of how the whole system works. So welcome to the show, everybody.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Paul, for the invitation.
Great. Why don't we and Zach Lohr's online. Zach, why don't we go ahead and start with you? Zach's on the calling in on the phone. So Zach, go ahead and introduce yourself, your organization.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation. My name is Zach Lohr. I'm with Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol. I've been with the patrol for about 7 years, and for the last 2 years, I've been the Ski Patrol Director and the representative to the National Ski Patrol System on behalf of our team.
Thanks, Zach. And Aaron?
Hi, my name is Aaron Bucklidge. I am unit leader of Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs here in South Central Alaska, based out of Anchorage. And then I am also a patroller with Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol.
All right, and we'll get into that. There's a lot of intermixing with all the different organizations. Amy?
Hi, and my name's Amy Holman, and I am the chair of the Alaska Incident Management Team for Search and Rescue, and I'm also involved in National Ski Patrol, both at the Alaska Division level as the Nordic Backcountry Supervisor and a member of the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol.
All right, thanks, Amy. And last but not least, Mark.
This is Mark Moralia. I'm the vice chair of the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, the vice president of the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, and the vice president of the Mountain Rescue Association. So I wear a lot of hats.
Yeah. Mark, why don't we go ahead and start with you and talk about the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group and sort of a little bit about their history and what they do, their mission.
Okay. Alaska Mountain Rescue Group was created back in 1960. It initially started out as the Alaska Rescue Group, and later on, about 2000, a name changed to the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group. Primarily, we are deployed by the Alaska State Troopers, since they are responsible for search and rescue throughout the state, except in national parks. We provide search. We provide high technical rock, ice, and snow response. We've got quite a few different resources. We have snow machines. We no longer have any ATVs. But our primary mission profile at this point seems to be search more than anything else. And luckily, over these last few years, there haven't been as many avalanche response calls. So I think people are finally learning a little bit about how to stay safe in backcountry.
Yeah, knock on wood. Mm-hmm. Now, my image of AMDR is that it's a little more technical in nature. Like when you are doing rescues, you are tend to be a little more in the technical. Is that as far as a high-angle rescue?
We train a lot for that, but our profile, or I should say, our mission profile is more search, really, than anything else. Over the years, we've done technical rescues, yes, but people tend to go missing more in a backcountry than they do getting, you know, stuck on cliffs in South Central Alaska.
Yeah. And, what are the qualifications someone needs to be involved? How does one get involved in MRG?
Well, you can go to the AMRG's website at amrg.org and go to the membership page and fill out an application. It's a lot of work and a lot of training that we do. You don't need to be a rock climber or an ice climber. You know, we have people that only do ground search. We have people that are avalanche specialists. We have people that do just rock and ice, and we have people that'll do all of those scenarios.
And typically, I assume there's first aid training, there's other kind of training that are involved, or is someone just walk in and say, I'm gonna do this? Is that?
We have a medical director. We are only a BLS certified organization, so we just provide basic life support. And the minimum medical requirement for our personnel is wilderness first aid.
Okay.
We have quite a few people, I think about 18 or so, who are woofers as well, wilderness first responders.
Okay, great. All right, we'll come back to MRG in a bit and more about other organizations you're involved. Amy?
Yeah, thanks. So the Alaska Incident Management Team for Search and Rescue, or you may hear me talk about AIMT SAR, was started back in 2011. So it's a reasonably new group, and it was started by the Alaska State Troopers, the State SAR coordinator, for the whole purpose of training people to be able to manage large and complex search and rescues. So we pull our membership from many of the different SAR organizations in South Central Alaska, plus federal and state agencies.
And so I'm probably least familiar with your organization. So expand a little bit on that. Like what is the organization like from like month to month or year to year? Like what are you up to? What kind of activities do you have going on?
Sure. Let me tell you a little bit about what AIMT SAR does. So we are a group of search managers in a number of different incident command positions that we're trained in. And we come in after a search has been going for a while. So for instance, my colleagues here will be called out first by the state troopers to try to find a lost person, for instance, or to address a avalanche search. And most searches are solved in the first 12 or to 24 hours. When they aren't, that's when the Alaska Incident Management Team for Search and Rescue generally gets called in, is to manage these multiple operational period searches, to manage the resources, and to bring in a additional level of search management expertise.
So these are folks that have a lot of training, it sounds like.
Yes, these are lots of dedicated folks, but not all of our positions require search and rescue training. So we work under the incident command system, and we have geographic information system specialists who help us out a ton, and you don't necessarily have to have search. It's a plus. We generally love to have folks who have search and rescue experience. But that, an IT person, doesn't necessarily have to have search to support us. But there are other positions, like when we have air operations, where we love to have those folks who have that in their background.
Do I recall some statewide, or maybe I should say area-wide training scenarios? Is that something you all put together?
Yes. In the past, we've been involved in doing at least region-wide trainings that bring in all of the different organizations in South Central Alaska. One of them was out in the valley a number of years ago and included the search and rescue teams out there, plus all of the ones represented here tonight.
Yeah, and I imagine that has to be very important in a serious incident where you might have multiple things going on.
Yeah, when the incidents get more complex and they aren't solved very quickly, there's a lot more going on. We're trying to bring in more resources. We've got different folks who may or may not have been able to work with each other beforehand. So there's a lot of moving parts, and it's great to have a team that has trained together that can help make that work smoothly.
Great. Thanks, Amy. Aaron?
Hi. So Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs has been operational since the mid-80s, 86, I believe. We train dogs to work side-by-side with us in a search and rescue scenario. So there's multiple disciplines that we may train in. So there may be a wilderness-type environment, or an avalanche, or track and trail, or human remains. And we train side-by-side with those dogs, that handler and that dog together, to go out and do our best to try and cover a huge amount of ground as fast as possible and try and get people in back where they're supposed to be. So for us, it is joining at whatever level you come in at. So for some people, it's technical support. For some people, it's, I want to be a handler, but I don't know where to start. For some people, they will be there next to the handler and not ever train a dog, but they want to be out there doing what they can to help that team fulfill their mission. And so we bring people in, we train them up until you're ready. If the dog can do it, the dog is your partner side by side, and we do what we can.
Dogs are always popular, so let's talk more about dogs.
That they are.
Yeah. And so I guess if I'm thinking, oh, I might do this, what am I looking at? What kind of commitment am I looking at?
That's a really good question. So typically, for somebody who comes in with absolutely no search and rescue background, it's going to take at least a year, if not longer, to get the human skills up to par to become deployable into the field. I want to say 18 months to 36 months is pretty average.
Now, wait a minute. So that's training the human?
That's training the human.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And then to train a dog to become an operational resource, we're looking at 2 to 3 years of training for the average person who has a day job. Now, if you're a police officer or you're retired and you're spending 1,000% of your time on this, it might be faster. Mm-hmm. But for most of us that have day jobs and we're just training nights and weekends, it's going to take 2 to 3 years of training your dog before you guys are ready to test and become an actual resource for these missions. So it's definitely a lot of work. Commitment. It's another part-time job, at least, on top of whatever else you got going on.
Yeah. And the testing, how rigorous is it? Is it people fail?
People do fail. Yeah. So the testing is dependent on what discipline you're testing in. So each discipline has a different set of criteria that we're working towards. There are national exams. There are in-house exams, depending on what organization you are focusing on and what their wheelhouse is. So for teams that tend to go out in the backcountry wilderness without a lot of in-town support, we require more, and you have to test to a different level than somebody who is never going to leave the green belt. So it depends on where you are and what your goal is, what discipline you're working.
Great, thanks. And obviously then there's people who can volunteer to help out, like be victims, patients, in rescues. There's other things that don't necessarily involve dogs, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the things we're always looking for is somebody to come hide for the dogs. So
you
take a book, take a chair, and go get lost, and we send the dogs in to come and find
you. Hope they've been trained well.
Yes. It is a little bit more supervised than just that. We definitely like new people to come hide, so the dogs always have new scents. And it's always fun to play with the puppies because it's a party every time the dogs get to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fun. All right, Zach's on the phone. Zach Liller, go ahead and introduce yourself and your organization, Zach.
I appreciate it. It's always tough to follow the dog act.
Sorry.
Impressive group. So Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol has actually been kind of at the thread of the Anchorage ski community for a long time. Actually, in preparing for today's talk, I was pulling up some statistics, and we're actually coming up on our 50-year anniversary for Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol. It actually started off as an offshoot of the Anchorage Ski Club, which is now the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage, back in 1973. It was kind of the brainchild of a couple of alpine patrollers who were patrolling up at Arctic Valley, the Denali Ski Patrol, back in the early 70s. And those individuals got involved in Nordic skiing events and recognized a need in the Anchorage Bowl for safety support. And so with the help of quite a few folks, they formed what at the time was only one of two Nordic ski patrols in the entire country. So we are associated with the National Ski Patrol System. We're a patrol within the Alaska Division and South Central Region. For the entire time, our mission has been static. Our dedication is to the Nordic skiing public. We promote outdoor safety, provide emergency care, and perform search and rescue support through our trained volunteer membership. Currently, our volunteer roster is approximately 30 people. About two-thirds of that, or about 20, are full patrollers, meaning that they have completed all of their requisite training and are capable of providing aid to the public. And the other 10 or so individuals are candidates. So we have a 1 to 2 year candidacy process where folks go through some fairly rigorous training. One of the primary courses that folks undertake is what we call our outdoor emergency care. It's the National Ski Patrol System's equivalent to a wilderness first responder. All of our members are trained in avalanche rescue and safety. So it's equivalent to the public's recreational avalanche level 1 with an additional organized search rescue component added. We also require mountain travel and rescue training and search and rescue specific training for all of our members. So that really sets us up well to provide a wide range of support to the skiing public. One of those functions is search and rescue, which, of course, we'll talk about more over the rest of the interview, where we work specifically with the Alaska State Troopers. But we also provide support to Nordic ski races here in town in Anchorage. We also provide support for a variety of backcountry tours, as well as backcountry patrols. We support large community events, so things like Ski for Kids, Ski for Women, Tour of Anchorage, the Ski Train, things like that. And then we also provide public education and outreach. Most recently, the last couple of years, we've been offering free avalanche beacon training and avalanche search training for the public. So that's pretty much us in a nutshell. You know, given the range of services that we provide, we obviously have multiple partners. With a search and rescue component, we work very closely with the Alaska State Troopers, and we are members of the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, ASARA. Most of our events are in support of the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage, and of course we have arrangements with the National Forest Service in Alaska State Parks in order to do work in the backcountry.
I had an I love a zoo, but in one of the ski races, not this winter but last winter, I fell. It was in the Sven Johansson at the bottom of Mises Folly, and I bloodied myself up pretty bad. One of the patrols were right there. It was very helpful. I mean, I was like, I'm fine, and they're like, no, you're not. And then he goes, what's your bib number? I'm like, well, no, I don't know my bib number. And I think it was sort of a cognitive check, but it was also, I looked at my bib and it was covered in blood. And that's when I realized that, I wasn't really all right. But I was very happy, very thankful you guys were there.
That was me. And I'm pretty sure that we used all of my guns.
I'm glad
that you were okay.
It looked like a moose kill. It was just a bloodied lip. But it was pretty funny. Anyways, yeah, I remember then skiing around and coming across the different patrols. I came across Trish Hermanhouse and then Joe Kurtak, and they're like, hey, Paul. Like, what's wrong with you? I'm fine. I'm going to finish. I think I finished last. But anyways, it was very nice that you guys were there. Yeah. Yeah. Very helpful. And then I think you all were at the finish waiting to see what I looked like at the end. So this is Alaska Public Media, and you're listening to The Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and we are talking about search and rescue in South Central Alaska today. Mark, let's come back to you and talk a little bit about history with NGR and AMRG, and sort of that a little bit about history of search and rescue in Alaska. And you started at one point, you mentioned that AMRG started working with the Park Service and then on Denali. Is that right?
Well, that was back in the early 60s and the early 70s. But, you know, that's just looking at the history that I've happened to read. You know, I didn't start with AMRG until 94. And at that point, you know, it was just we'd respond to the Alaska State Troopers. We would respond anywhere in the state below 10,000 feet because we're living at majority of us are from the Anchorage area and some from Mat-Su Valley. And we're not going to go up to 17 feet the day after living at sea level. So that was our cutoff. We have gotten deployed around the state for various searches, but most of those around the state, unfortunately, have been responding to aircraft accidents for recoveries. Mm-hmm. So we've been transported with the U.S. Coast Guard helicopters out onto the chain in the past to go ahead and do aircraft recoveries out in that area. You know, I had mentioned earlier that it seems like the majority of our searches are search-related right now, but we have had several high-profile technical rescues as well that have, you know, usually the calls come in late in the day or at night, and, you know, you have to go out and work in poor weather through the night, you know, and you've been working all day, and then you get called out at 6 o'clock at night, and you're working through the night.
And that's usually cold.
It usually happens when the weather's bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to be physically fit to do the work, and it can be challenging at times, let's say that.
Yeah.
But we also have quite a few folks that are part of the Alaska Incident Management Team that are trained in search management. So typically when AMRG gets called out, we will begin to manage the mission, and we have been able to manage the mission through the first and second days. But the issue we have here in South Central before the AMT came about was if the mission goes more than a couple of days, you're starting to run out of those folks that are skilled to manage it. And that's why, as Amy pointed out, the AMT was created to provide more personnel trained in search management.
Let's talk about that. Go to how that structure works. So I call 911, or I hit my SOS button on my inReach. So then what happens? Who wants to take that?
So depending on what device you're using or how you make that call out, it'll change a little bit how it goes. For instance, your Garmin inReach goes to a private company that then alerts the system here in Alaska. In general, 911, you'll get to the Alaska State Troopers, and that then the troopers get information, basic information about what's going on, and then they will look through all of the resources that they have at their disposal, including the groups here with you tonight, and call out those groups that are appropriate for the incident. And so there's a call out, and then those groups are activating their members, and each group has a certain time period by which that they pull their members together, and we get some information about where to deploy to, whether it's a staging area, whether it's somewhere here locally, like a trailhead, or whether in some cases we're getting transported either by helicopter or by plane to another area. And so the teams get activated, and then they go out, hopefully bringing the subject back in good condition within a short amount of time. If it continues on, that's when more resources can get called in by the troopers. And also, we, a lot of times, the troopers will call in through the RCC. And we'll get DOD.
And that stands for the Rescue Coordination Center.
Yes, the Rescue Coordination Center. Thanks. And then we'll get DOD assets to help as well.
And that's Department of Defense. And what we're really talking there is the 210th and the 212th. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And those are the professionals. Yeah, you want to talk about that, Mark?
Well, there's also the Alaska Army National Guard. Yep. Lately, they've also been quite active in helicopter rescues and hoists. They have hoist capabilities just like the PJs do.
Okay. And so those professionals, and they're really, my primary mission is military, but they do a lot for civilians. We're very fortunate in this state to have them.
We are.
Yeah. And also, what about the difference between land and water? Let's talk about that. So what happens when I'm out on a boat in Prince William Sound?
So in general, the jurisdiction for the water is the U.S. Coast Guard. And so they will get called out. They will activate their nearest assets, and that whole process will get in motion. I think you have a lovely chat with Coast Guard about their whole process totally a evening of that of your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I have I've been involved in a few rescues out there, and they're very professional, and it's very impressive what they can do. Let's... so we've got a response. So Zach, Aaron, do you have any other thoughts about response and how that all works?
I would say one of the additions for response is that a lot of times when we get the call from the troopers, they have an idea of what resources they think are going to be helpful. And for us, in the last few years especially, we've been working as almost an internal dog dispatch above and beyond the initial dispatch. So what I mean by that is troopers will call, they'll say, okay, we think we need dogs on this. This is the situation. We'll start digging more because we have an idea of what capabilities not only our group has, but some of the other dog groups, whether that's here in South Central or whether that's a little further out, depending on what the situation is. And we can help dispatch within our discipline. And so it's an all hands on deck. It's a community effort. It's a, well, I don't have that right now because we've got a couple people out of town. So let me check with these guys and let me check with these guys. And then there's massive effort to get the right people in the right place at the right time to do our best as a community to get people home.
Yep. And that sounds complex to me. Like that coordination. I mean, because you're all, I assume, more or less volunteers, and you have regular lives. So how does that work? Like how does, is this someone at troopers sort of start making phone calls, or what's the?
There's a lot of phone calls involved. Yeah. A lot of phone calls, a lot of text messages. So I think with each group, we have kind of our own phone tree, both within our group. So the dispatcher for that group gets a call, but then the dispatchers also tend to have the contact information for the other groups. so that we can say, hey, ASARD got called. I think we're going to need more people. We're going to need more humans. Let's call Ski Patrol. I think AMRG is also around. Let's call them. Let's see who we've got. And we'll start calling these other dispatchers for the other organizations to find out, you know, I think this is ramping up pretty fast. What do you got for us? Mm-hmm. Who can you send? What kind of response can you put forth? And, you know, there's definitely some logistics involved with that. There's also a lot of group text messages. And sometimes in the age of Zoom, I think we've done some Zoom calls for some of these. And, you know, working with the coordinator, working with, in some cases, the police department. And just, it's a lot of, you do this, using that incident management system to make sure that we're utilizing everyone's time and energy efficiently.
That's Zach, from the North Sea Patrol's perspective and response, do you have any insights?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team so far has done a fantastic job of kind of describing the coordination and the original outreach that it takes to get something like this going. Anchorage Nordic's kind of in a unique situation. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we've been around for quite a while, so the capacity is there, the reputation is there, and we have really well-developed partnerships with the troopers, with the search dog organizations, with AMRG, AIMT, all the alphabet soup. But we also have, we're a relatively large group, and we have individuals that wear multiple hats. So as Erin introduced herself, she's also a ski patroller. Amy is also a ski patroller. We have several other folks that have lead positions in search and rescue that are members of our group. So quite often when there's an initial call out, it goes to a relatively small specialized group to start that coordination process. And Anchorage Nordic often gets put on notice. So while we certainly do have folks that can lead a search and rescue, we are quite often in the second to third round of people that actually get deployed to the field. But we're often on maybe first or second round of people that get put on notice. And so we do a really good job with our members of being excellent, diverse teammates. So we can kind of fill a lot of roles. So when an AMRG or a dog team has a mission that goes a little long and they realize that they're going to need some resources, we can kind of backfill a lot of those vacancies. And so our call out process is a phone tree. We use primarily an email and text messaging system. And we kind of start with a few key individuals that are designated as initial points of contact. And then those individuals, depending on the nature of the mission, start reaching out to our membership, collecting who's available, what their time constraints are, and start putting together initial teams that would be deployable for a variety of different roles. And then when the people that are actually leading the event need that help, we can quickly say, hey, these are the resources that we can bring to bear. So that's kind of how our system works.
Thanks, Sullivan. Thanks, Zach. This is Paul Torlak with Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about search and rescue in South Central Alaska on Alaska Public Media. We're going to take a short break and be right back with more from our guests.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlak. We're talking about search and rescue in South Central Alaska. So we left off with sort of some of the response. Amy, why don't you talk a little bit about when the call comes in, you have a little bit of information, but what do you do when you don't have the good information? What happens then?
Thanks, Paul. I mean, some people might, you know, we talked a little bit about how we deploy our teams, but there's actually a lot of work that goes in on the backside to learn everything we can about what's going on, about the subject, about their tendencies. You know, we have the incident command system, which you hear referred to as ICS. But in our world, we also have another version of ICS, and that's investigate, contain, and search. So once you get a call out, there's a tremendous amount of information that can be gained that can hone in the search before searchers even start down a trailhead. And that's incredibly important to what we do. And investigation is something that we do throughout the entire search. You know, Mark likes to talk about some of the cases where we don't exactly get all the right information at the beginning. Mark?
Thanks, Amy. That's very true. A lot of times GPS coordinates come in, you don't know what datum they're in, or you plot them on a map and it shows something that doesn't make any sense at all. So typically when AMRG gets a call, we have about half a dozen people that we call agency representatives. We've got one main phone number that the troopers call, and any one of those ARs can pick up the call, get the initial information from the trooper, and then typically they'll contact another AR and have them start finding what resources
an AR is
agency representative.
Oh, okay.
They're the only people that can actually commit AMRG resources to a mission. So once that call comes in, you know, and the AR is looking at getting how many resources might be available for the type of a mission, they've got another agency representative who's making further calls out to the reporting party, if we can get that information from the troopers, and start getting further data from them on what exactly happened, how many people involved, and what type of mission is it? Is avalanche response? Is somebody missing? Is this somebody stuck up on a cliff? And information like that.
Yeah. And that's another role that the Alaskan Incident Management Team for Search and Rescue can do in support of volunteer search and rescue teams. Is it takes a while to mobilize and to get everybody. As Aaron said, most of us have different day jobs. So you got to get home, get your gear together, and you're hustling. But it does take some time. In the meantime, the Alaska Incident Management Team for Search and Rescue, we can do a lot virtually. So we do everything from a virtual search plan, where basically we do a lot of investigation. We look at lost person behavior. We look at the weather. We look at information that we can find from people's social media accounts, everything that can tell us more about the subject, and such that we can, in a very short amount of time, put together an initial kind of snapshot of the subject and what we know about them, what their tendencies are, and then make some recommendations about here's probably what might be some of the first things to consider for that team when they hit the trailhead. And that can all be done while they're in transit. And luckily, with many of the places that we're working, we do have the ability to communicate that out to those teams.
Yeah, that's there's so much that's going on. Let's talk a little bit about ASARA a little bit more, a little bit about the history and what it is. So, what does it stand for?
Yeah, ASARA stands for the Alaska Search and Rescue Association.
Yeah,
and it was initially started up back in 1992 by First Sergeant Paul Burke, who was the Alaska State Trooper SAR coordinator at the time. It kind of lost interest and petered out for a bit. But then in 2004, Lieutenant Craig McDonald, who was the SAR coordinator at that time, got the ball rolling again and created ASARA primarily as an organization, an umbrella organization for the volunteer SAR organizations in the state, to provide resources as far as sharing information and things of that nature. But it started out, Chuck Springer was the first president, and he approached Senator Ted Stevens and got a national grant from the federal government for training, $200,000 back in 2010. And that money was used to provide training courses for all of the ASARA member organizations. They would apply for grant funding for various courses, and if the board of directors of ASARA approved it, they were able to put on the courses. And over the years since then, ASARA has been able to get several other grants. These are state grants that they've been getting lately. And again, this is to provide training to the ASARA member organizations throughout the state. And this could be training like, you know, high angle technical rope rescue, wilderness first responder, avalanche courses, search rescue dog courses, and various training courses like that. So ASARA is made up of board of directors, and the directors represent each various region of the state: the North Slope, Matsu Valley, Southeast, South Central, it's Western U.S. as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk about ways people can contribute, but I assume individuals can contribute to every organization, correct?
Absolutely.
Every organization's got a donate button on their page.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like dogs. If I want to support dogs, how do I support dogs?
So for ASARD, we have a page on our website that you can go, and there's a number of different ways to donate listed there. So one is Pick, Click, Give. One is the Combined Federal Campaign, or CFC. We were doing Amazon Smiles until they stopped. Let's see what else. We also accept checks. Donation of time is also a big thing. Yeah, so, you know, it doesn't have to be a financial contribution, although we love financial contributions because we are, every organization is volunteer, and we are paying for the majority of our gear and training out of our own pockets. So anything that anyone can do to support is very much appreciated.
Yeah. And Zach, how can people support the Nordic Ski Patrol besides volunteering?
Oh, I was chuckling as I was listening to the other three say that we all have donate buttons. I think Anchorage Nordic's probably the one organization that makes it hard to give us money. we are not an official nonprofit, so we are not eligible for certain things like Pick, Click, Give and other types of donations. But we do receive donations. In particular, one of our primary services that we provide is assisting with Nordic ski races and backcountry tours and large social events for the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage. And they do provide us with a generous donation to help support our training, replacement of our equipment, and things like that. And there's a lots of ways that people can donate to that organization to support their mission, trail maintenance here in Anchorage, and then obviously them passing through certain dollars to help their volunteer organizations exist. But I would actually, you know, echo what Aaron said. You know, the volunteering people's time. You know, we're a 100% volunteer organization. The strength in our group is in our volunteers. You know, we ask people to contribute at least 8 days a year during the winter. So that's about, you know, two days a month during the snowy months anyway. And that goes a long way. We also have a board of directors. We have other ways that people can help support the patrol through helping to write grants and things like that. So supporting us through time and getting engaged is a fantastic way. And so to that effect, we do have a website. Our website is anchoragenordicski.com. And we have a candidate application on our website for folks that are interested in getting involved.
And we'll have all those links to the different websites and organizations on the Outdoor Explorer website.
Awesome. Thanks.
Zach, let's continue to do a little bit. I want to spend a bunch of the rest of the show talking about prevention and then a little bit more about response from the field, from the recreationalist or educator, whoever's out there, hunter, fisherman, subsistence person, aircraft pilot, whoever. So let's start with prevention. So Zach, why don't you talk a little bit about preparing for a trip and what one should do?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that Anchorage Nordic does is help prevent accidents in the backcountry, especially with the tours and patrols that we do in the backcountry. That's a big part of our focus is setting a good example. You know, the tours that we help to lead, you know, making sure that people are properly prepared before they leave the trailhead, you know, watching their physical and mental condition throughout the trip and just providing them the support to not get into an accident. It's a big part of who we are. But with that comes a lot of, you know, personal responsibility recreating in the backcountry. I mean, obviously being knowledgeable of where you want to go, what the conditions are going to be for the day, being mentally and physically prepared for that trip, packing good equipment. You know, we have lists like the 10 essentials, as an example, and there's varieties of those lists that you can look up online. They kind of help guide people to what should be in your pack, you know, in order to be generally prepared for most backcountry situations. But trip planning is huge, and a big part of that is understanding the terrain that you're going to cover, having a good understanding of how long it's likely to take you to complete the trip, making sure that you've documented the steps that it's going to take to get from point A to point Z, and making sure that you've clearly left a trip plan with a responsible party who's going to take it seriously and kind of monitor your status and be prepared to relay that trip plan to search and rescue members should something happen.
What other advice do folks have for preparation to keep yourself out of trouble?
I think one of the things just living up here in Alaska is being ready for change in the weather, change in your plans, making sure that you're not just thinking about what it looks like right now, but what it looks like throughout your trip and what could happen if something goes wrong along the way.
Yeah.
I was going to mention that's the what ifs. You know, think ahead of time. What if somebody gets hurt? You know, what are we going to do? What if we get lost? So you need to have a plan to address all of those if something does happen, because unplanned stuff happens all the time in the backcountry. So you need to have thought ahead of time how to deal with it when something happens. And people rely a lot on cell phones nowadays, but a lot of times what we find, by the time somebody calls for help, their cell phone battery is a little bit too low and they lose communication. So you need to make sure if you're going to rely on your cell phone for navigation and for those selfie pictures and all of that, that you've got a spare source of battery so that if something happens, you can charge your phone so you can maintain communication. And it's also important to learn how to forward your GPS coordinates from your phone to SAR resources. There's various ways to do it, and you just Google it online and find out how to do it. But iPhones make it real simple nowadays.
That's very helpful, Mark. Also, I'd say that one thing, we talk about the difference in Alaska before the lower 48, and that we're remote very fast here. Does anybody want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'll kick it off, and I think all of us have something to say about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes just with what Mark was saying about the what ifs. And, you know, we start out and we're on a really nice local trail here, but it doesn't take very long to get to a place where it's going to take over 2 hours to have medical response for you if something happens. And, you know, that happens just right here behind town. Now, you don't have to go out into broader areas to have that happen. You know, there's many cases where that happens just in the state park here behind us. And certainly it gets exacerbated as you're getting into more wilderness areas.
Yeah, I like to think that even Kincaid and Zach, I remember my little incident when I fell, we were in a hole. Like, you were down there in the bottom of Mises Folly. There's no cell service, and it's a little bit of ways out of there, right?
It absolutely is. I mean, I know if, and actually I did it during the spend this last year for various reasons, help somebody looking for a lost pair of glasses, but just walking the trail at the end of the race from about that point back to Kincaid took us an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know, so it's even Kincaid Park can be a difficult situation if something happens. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think of mountain bikers, single track mountain bikers, mountain runners that are a lot of times carrying very little. And you know, you're biking around Camel Track, it can be cold in there. I mean, you can go from service where it's 20 degrees down into Camel Track where it's zero pretty fast. And if you're by yourself and have a, you know, oopsie-daisy, it can be good serious very fast.
So one of the other things that people can do both in their preparation and dealing with suddenly being a little further away from the car than they expected is not just having the 10 essentials or, you know, having the extra layers of clothes, but learning the skills. So having a little bit of medical background, you don't have to be an EMT. You don't have to go take one of these classes that we're taking, but some basic first aid. And thinking about, okay, well, how could I do this first aid skill if I don't have a first aid kit, if I've only got the clothes I'm wearing? How could I do this? And learning the navigation skills, not just relying on my GPS, but familiarizing yourself with the trails and knowing which way the road is, knowing which way the mountains are compared to the direction you're going, so that you can help get yourself out of whatever situation you got yourself into. And then you know, if you're going to be playing in snow country at all, if there's any snow on the ground, knowing how you're going to react in an avalanche, knowing your beacon probe and shovel skills, knowing how to pick your path so that you're not in danger. All of those things are super important. So it's not just about having the gear, it's about knowing how to use it.
Excellent. Excellent points. This is Alaska Public Media. You're listening to the Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlett. We're talking about search and rescue in Alaska. And back to that point, I also think recognizing when you're in avalanche terrain, too. I mean, you know, I could be on the coastal trail. I'm probably okay. There's snow on the ground. I'm probably okay. But then hypothermia, you know, frostbite, just understanding and understanding one's limitations, too. Another thing, I think, how important is it, and any thoughts about in town, like when I'm planning a trip, and maybe Zach, you can take this one, about having that in town contact. How important is that? What should that person be able to know what to do?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I think it somewhat depends on what the in-town, you know, event is. You know, I mean, a casual run on one of the single track trails or around Kincaid Park, you know, I mean, those things become pretty commonplace for a lot of us that live here in town. And but even stuff like that, you know, letting someone know that you're going for a run or a bike ride or a dog walk and where you're going, letting them know when you're taking off, when you plan on coming back, what your general travel route is. And ideally, you know, sticking to that plan, you know, even though it's in town, you know, if you're overdue for some reason, that person that you've notified, you know, is going at some point in time is going to call somebody. You know, they're either going to call a friend, you know, probably to start off with, you know, but eventually if you don't come home, they're going to elevate that, you know, most likely through 911, and that'll kick off a series of prompts that Amy and Mark and Aaron talked about earlier in the show. But generally speaking, if you're the one that's notifying someone that a friend or a loved one is missing, you're going to be the witness. You're going to be the one that people are going to be asking questions of to try and figure out where to start that search. So the more that you can know about how your friends and family, when they go out in the backcountry or even just trails here in town, you know, what they're wearing, where they're likely to go, what their general patterns are, you know, how prepared they are for a particular event, the more that you can relay, the better. In starting to initiate that search.
And any advice, let's say I am the in-town person and my friend or partner or family members overdue, any advice on when I should call? An hour? So how long should I wait? And Mark, you talked about the evening hour, you know.
Let me just back up a minute and add a little bit on your trip plan. If you're planning a multi-day trip in the backcountry, AST, I know in the past they had a formal trip plan that you could file with troopers or you could give it to a friend to keep. But you need to include equipment that you have with you, because if you're in a backcountry and we're flying a search for you, if you say what you have in the way of gear, color of your tent, how much food you have, you know, other items like that that would help us identify you as we're flying overhead looking, that would be beneficial. So, you know, if it's just a little trip in town for the day, you know, you're not going to be taking a lot with you. But if you're going to do a multi-day trip, even if it's like the Crow Pass crossing and you're going to spend a couple of days camping on there, include all that information in your trip plan to leave it. That helps a lot.
Yeah.
But as far as when to put out the call, you should put out the call early. Because the one thing to bear in mind, especially if you're waiting for rescue, it's not going to happen as quick as you want it to. It does take time, because we are all volunteers, to get the resources mobilized. Also, transport into the location can take time as well. If the weather's poor, travel time is going to be increased. If the weather's good, we might be able to get a helicopter from the state troopers. There's only one state trooper helicopter in town that can do search and rescue, and their primary responsibility is law enforcement. It's not SAR. So, you know, time is of the essence, and you're going to be waiting for rescue, especially if there's a medical situation involved. You need to get the call in as soon as possible.
So that was a little bit talking about if I'm in town, let's go to the field. Let's go out and I'm out. And where I think about different levels of emergencies. I think about, fatalities at the worst, right? Maybe probably the worst, but also maybe a missing person or a sprained ankle. And it's so easy to call nowadays, and you hear a lot of stories, especially in Lower 48, and a little bit more and more up here, people being rescued. Maybe they didn't really need that help. So what's your advice there? Anybody want to take that one? I'm in the field, and I having to decide like when am I gonna hit the SOS button or call 911. Zach,
we're probably all a little tentative on that one, just because
I couldn't see your face, so you're on. Yeah.
Question, really? I mean, I think the one thing to keep in mind, and maybe I'll just get it started and look to the rest of the team to kind of back me up here with some different perspectives. But you know, if you're in trouble, hit the button. I mean, just what Mark said, whether it's an in-town response or a wilderness backcountry response, I mean, the same thing applies. You know, we, the search and rescue community, would much rather be put on notice and then asked to stand down because everything's okay than we would to get the call when it's really too late to do much of anything about it for the immediate future. So if you're really in trouble, hit the button.
So stop for a minute. What do you mean really in trouble?
Well, I think that's where I was going to go. You know, if it's life or limb, you know, I think that's really in trouble. You know, you need help, and it is justified in pulling the resources together to come and provide the assistance, because it will be a big lift. But with that said, if you're just uncomfortable, if you're just frustrated, that's not the time to hit the button. So maybe I just kind of leave it there for the moment and see what other folks want to bring to that perspective.
Any thoughts on that?
I'll say that sometimes delay can put rescuers at risk, especially if the weather's poor. I mean, if you're going into avalanche terrain because somebody's trapped or somebody's been involved in an avalanche, and you're going in and hopefully fast enough that you can get a recovery, excuse me, get a rescue rather than a recovery, it's it's much better to go in early rather than late.
Yep. Any other thoughts?
So I would say if it involves a child or an elder or someone with a medical history that is concerning, your litmus test changes. If your child disappears from you on the trail, don't wait. Call. Start screaming. Start looking. But call. If you have an elder who is running into trouble, absolutely call. These are the times where it can get beyond your scope of abilities very fast. And having us start mobilizing early is paramount to the difference between a very uncomfortable day versus a serious hospital stay or worse. And it's been said, we would much rather be put on standby. And then as things develop, we find out, you know what, actually, we don't need anybody to come out. We got this covered. Then find out that we were too late because somebody was worried about calling us too early.
Right. Yeah,
that is not a place any of us want to be. So you know, there's some it depends in there for sure. If it's just I'm tired, I need a Snickers. Okay, like tough it out and get as close as you can. And if it turns worse, yes, call. But if we're talking about you broke something, you cannot mobilize yourself, or a member of your party cannot mobilize themselves, if the weather is looking like it's coming in bad, if it's involving a child or an elder or a health issue, and you don't have the meds with you that you're going to need soon, any of that stuff, that escalates it for sure.
Good advice.
One thing I'll add is people should remember that there is no charge for rescue services in the state of Alaska.
Really? Yeah. That's but elsewhere there might be.
In other states, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Good to know. I want to talk about lost people. We're talking about search, we're doing a search and rescue. So we're talking a lot about rescue. But I also want to I'm interested in if I lost a member of my party, how long should I look? How long till when do I call? And I'm interested in this. I've always wondered, what really, I mean, how long? Because the tendency is to go find them yourself. But the, like Marco said, the longer we wait, the later it gets.
And I'll just start this out by saying, you know, what going back to that preventative side is, you know, I have a friend who goes out hunting and he'll take an airplane in. And one of the first things I talk to him about with his plan is, you know, so how long are you going to be out? When do you expect to be back? Yeah. Also, what's your buffer? How much do you have? When do I need to start worrying about you? Because, you know, when we're on particularly some of the longer trips, it's not uncommon to have things delay us and we're fine. And if we're out in the wilderness, we may not have the communications to be able to tell that back. So I just add to this piece of, you know, make sure from the start you're thinking about these things. And that's something also that, you know, pulling into some of the things Aaron said is that you will know about that family member also is, you know, how well, what do they take into the field? Are they prepared? You know, should I wait a little bit? You know, what's their style? If their hiking style is, wow, they were planning on this trail, but if there was something really beautiful that and they decided that the weather was nice and maybe they were feeling good and they'd go a little further, then that all plays into it as well. So I'll just kick that off and see if anybody else wants to jump in.
Yeah,
I talk specifically to your question, Paul. I would say is if you have communication and someone in your party is lost, contact authorities right away to make them aware of it so they can start spooling up and then continue to look for your party. And as long as you got communication, if you find them, you can call back in and cancel the request.
Yeah.
But at least you're getting the clock rolling because, like I said, it'll take a while to get people involved.
Yep.
And that also, I'll just add to that, is if you've got that communication, then you can also have that be part of the way to help them help themselves get out. And it really works well in talking with us.
This has been absolutely fascinating. Any more last thoughts? We have about a minute left or so on sort of response and people's responsibilities toward the search and rescue community.
I think maybe the last thing that that I would comment on, you know, especially for folks that that have the ability to maintain some type of remote communication with folks in town, provide updates. You know, whether that's a cell phone, which as we already mentioned, you kind of lose cell phone service relatively easily here in the state, but you know, an inReach, a satellite phone, you know, if you have those types of tools. You know, develop a system where you're going to provide some updates on a semi-regular basis. That way, if you delay, people know about it. If you change your plans, people know about it. If you decide to go check out that that extra braid in the river or stay a little bit longer to watch the sunset, people know about it. I'm a big proponent of just keeping people involved to the extent possible anyway.
Thanks, Zach. That was Zach Littler with the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol. I've also had Mark Moralia with Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, Aaron Buckledge with Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs, and Amy Holman with the Alaska Incident Management Team. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests, Zach Littler, Mark Moralia, Aaron Buckledge, and Amy Holman. And a big thanks to our producer, Airport. This is your host, Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening. Be safe out there, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.